Okay. Let's start today with sort of continue. Yesterday we were talking about a particular Russian NGO which deals with human rights cases and regular cases, sometimes strategically litigating cases. And today we will speak about how this NGO and other Russian NGOs dealt with the European Convention on Human Rights, how they used this instrument and the case law of the European Court domestically, in domestic courts, before going to the European Court. And I call this seminar, this lecture, Bringing Human Rights Home. This is the main idea of any international law, and particularly the European Convention on Human Rights. We quite often forget that the European Convention on Human Rights starts not with Article 2, right to life and so on. It starts with Article 1, which says that all the states ratified the European Convention undertook the obligation to bring all these guarantees of the Convention, all these provisions of the Convention, to be implemented at the national level, at the national legal system at the first place. And then, if it didn't work out, applicants can come to the European Court and ask for compensation. So, today we will speak about some examples, and mainly we will speak about the overall picture of the application of the Convention in Russian courts. And the two seminars afterwards, we will speak about particular cases, application of the Convention in Russian courts. So, we'll start with the accession of Russia to the Council of Europe. It happens in 1996, but before, in 1993, or I think even in 1992, there was a negotiation about accession to the Council of Europe with a letter sent by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to the Committee of to the Council of Europe, expressing the willingness to join this international organ institution. And of course, before making any decision whether to accept Russia or not, Council of Europe conducted a research or investigation and sent a group of researchers to Russia to basically make a conclusion whether the Russian Federation is ready to join the Council of Europe. There is Article 3 in the Charter of the Council of Europe, which says that basically that any state can join Council of Europe if the legal system of this particular country corresponds to the level of protection guaranteed by the Council of Europe, by the European Convention. So the point of this research, of this investigation, was to establish whether the legal system of the Russian Federation corresponds to the guarantees given by the instruments of the Council of Europe. And it was a big paper published, a big article published on which gives details of what the group of these people, researchers, found out about the Russian legal system. But the main conclusion was the legal system of the Russian Federation does not correspond to the standards. Interestingly, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs arrived to the same conclusion. It was a letter, information letter published by the chinomics of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which says, conclude almost the same, that the legal system, the legal order of the Russian Federation, with one exception, the Russian Constitution, does not correspond to the standards of the Council of Europe. So, in these circumstances, the Council of Europe made a political decision to, despite this fact, despite the fact that there is no compliance with the standards, European standards, we will accept the Russian Federation to the Council of Europe. And the reason was that it's better to accept Russia and help it to rise the standards to the level of the European standards, rather than to leave it aside and do it on your own. And no, there is no guarantee that those standards will ever reach their required standards. So the US made this decision.
What do you personally think? Who's the decision? If I may ask.
Yes, I think it was a wise decision, and it proves that it was a correct decision after 16 years now. Mm-hmm. That only because of this accession, and only because of the fact that Russia ratified the European Convention 2 years after, there were a lot of changes in the Russian legal system made, only because there was influence of the Council of Europe. Political pressure, judgments, you've heard today just two examples out of many where there was a positive influence of the Council of Europe on the Russian legal system. And I, from the point of view of a Russian lawyer working with NGOs, you can see that sometimes there is no hope to deal with the situation, to get a positive result by the European Court. Unfortunately, it takes 5-7 years to go to the European Court to get the decision. So, 2 years after, one of the requirements of Russia joining the Council of Europe was ratification of the convention. And 2 years later, Russia ratified the convention, and it entered into force for Russia May 5th, 1998. And in this, law, federal law on ratification of the convention, Russia stated that the Russian Federation recognized the jurisdiction of the European Court in terms of delivering the judgments and in terms of interpretation of the European Convention by the European Court. Meaning that the only official interpretation of the European Convention can be done by the European Court of Human Rights, and we are bound by those decisions. But in practice, the general understanding of joining the European Convention was, ratifying the European Convention was that now everybody got the right to appeal to the European Court. This was the only sort of positive thing. Nobody thought about European Convention being applied in Russian courts, although it was the first meeting of the European Convention and the process of ratification. And I think, despite the fact that this very positive federal law on ratification, which explained the jurisdiction of the European Court, I think many politicians and many lawyers actually understood the overall deepness, glubina, of this process, of this fact that Russia joined Council of Europe and ratified the convention. Before that, Russia was, the Soviet Union was one of the first countries that ratified the most of international treaties on human rights and social, civil, political rights. All the UN treaties were joined by Russia, most of them. And they were always ratified but never published in the Soviet Union. I recently had a conversation with somebody who said that it was impossible. He was a Dutch ambassador, member of the Dutch embassy in Russia, in Russia, who was ambassador, member of the embassy even in the 80s. He said, despite the fact that Russia ratified so many, conventions, and even was party to the Declaration, Human Rights Declaration, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you could not find any texts published in the libraries anywhere. And it struck me that even before I read an article by one Russian scholar who was a leading scholar on international law, he died in the 90s, in the end of the 90s. He will come.
Danilenko.
He mentioned that in one of his articles, that article 99, published in 1999, he said that it's still very difficult to find any texts of international treaties, even of the European Convention, in our libraries, let alone, not to mention judgments from the international courts.
Anton, do you mind if I intervene with one sentence? Mm-hmm. So we had the same situation in Estonia as part of the Soviet Union. It was when I studied law in the 90s, it was, and I looked at the historical professors of international law at Tartu University, it was difficult for me to understand what other people said about Avner Rustav's book on the United Nations in the early 80s. Everyone was talking about the real significance was that in the end of this book, he managed to print the two UN covenants on human rights. And that was the actual, the progressive part. And no one, there was no other place to see the texts of those covenants. And, for succeeding generations, especially for you living in the internet, it must be something hard to realize.
And it's still the same in 2006. Well, not the same, but situation changes quite very steadily. In 2006, I read an article by Pavel Laptev, a former agent for the Russian Federation before the European Court. And in one of the conferences, he said, "But look, we ratified the convention 8 years ago. We still have no courses, legal courses, on the European Convention in our law schools. What kind of change do you want to receive?" And even today, last year, the UN Committee on Human Rights delivered an opinion which says that Russian legislation violates rights of detained, sentenced people, right to vote. There is a blank prohibition of all the people who are detained, sentenced, criminally charged and sentenced, and they are in prison, and they all have no right to vote. And the UN committee delivered this opinion that none of them have right to vote, and it's a violation of the Convention on Civil Political Rights. And it was in May 2011, right before all the Russian elections. And none of the Russian lawyers, you cannot find any mentioning of this opinion of international tribunal about the right to vote of all these detained prisoners during the elections where they actually have to vote. And no, there was no publication of this opinion in Russian until December, and only American University, Minnesota University, published this translation. This is the situation. So, what I was going to say that when Russia ratified the European Convention, the politicians who did this, they didn't expect the legal force, bindingness of the European Court judgments, the bindingness of the European Convention, because of the previous experience. It was easy to ratify any international treaties and forget about them, but not with the European Convention, not with the European Court. Yesterday, Judge Kogler mentioned 1,400 judgments against Russia, most of them for the applicants, and they all legally binding. And it's not only about compensation; it's all about also general measures, individual measures. They have to be followed, executed, and that's the nobody. Could understand in 1998 that what that means to ratify the European Convention. I think even the Council of Europe didn't really understand. And so, because of this understanding that it's all about going to the European Court, it's not about bringing cases, application of the Convention in Russia, here is the picture. Can you see it? This is official statistics by the European Court of applications going to the European Court. So this is this pie, and the biggest part of this pie is 24.1% belongs to Russia. So 24% of all the applications going to the European Court belong to Russia. The next one is, I guess, Turkey, 11%, Italy, Romania, Ukraine. These are the other states, like small states. Of course, if you divide this number by population, Russia will not be on the first place, but it's not an excuse. And so this is about 144,000 applications in total. And 34,000, almost 35,000, coming from Russia. Of course, this is just application; it's not judgments, which are delivered by the European Court. Maybe 98% of these applications will be recognized inadmissible or struck out of the file for some reason, won't be considered. And another statistic is a number of judgments delivered by the European Court against a particular country. Turkey is leading right now, 15%, Russia is almost there. But if you count all the pilot judgments, all the repetitive cases, I guess Russia will overcome Turkey. So what kind of violations Russia has, what kind of violations European Court of Human Rights recognized in regard to Russia? This is statistics of 2011. By the way, it's all available on the website of the European Court. The European Court is very good in publishing. If you read annual reports, it's a separate document, like 100 pages, very interesting document. Separate files and statistics, it's all in color, so just to give you a very good picture on all the countries, not only Russia. What's interesting and striking about cases in regard to Russia is this first line. There are 53 cases about the right to life. The most important, of course, guarantee. 58 instances of violation of the right to effective investigation. If there was a fact of disappearance or somebody was killed, you had this relatives of this person has a right to effective investigation of this case, as you see, rightfully respected. The same about torture. Since instances of torture proven is occasions in human and degrading treatment 62, it's all mostly about conditions in prisons.
So, did
the 6 torture
cases also include like cases with many advocates in one case?
No.
But why are there 6
torture cases? Well, for the reasons, it's actually quite difficult to prove instances of torture. We will speak about one of those cases later on. And again, right to effective investigation of the violation of the right to torture, or sorry, freedom from torture treatment. 68 occasions of right to liberty and security. It's only in 1 year. It's not 12, 14 years of jurisdiction of the court. This is about pre-trial detention. So people who were not accused, they're not criminal, nobody proved that they committed any crime, they are in prison for 2, 3, or 4 years, as Judge Kotler mentioned before. Just 68 occasions which reached the European Court. Right to a fair trial, this is quite a small number right now, but it's only because of the pilot judgment, both of number 2 versus Russia. Length of proceedings, no execution of judgments, effective remedy, 58 cases. And property, look at this number, 26. And right now, many entrepreneurs, businessmen, started to use this article. It's Article 1, Protocol 1 to the European Convention, the guarantee of the right to property. If you know this software called Kaspersky, have you heard of this? There's a Norton antivirus, but Kaspersky is a Russian mate, a businessman who developed this software. He's filing a case against Russia on the right to property. And this is also striking. Home cases, around 90% are repetitive. It's all the same. All the same. So far we have 2 pilot judgments, which we were talking about today, and as I understood, 1 more is coming. Before starting this lecture, I thought of mentioning that it's actually quite difficult to evaluate whether Russia is doing good in terms of coping with these judgments and trying to implement convention in Russia, changing the legal system, because it's all relative. If you compare it with the United Kingdom, which was the party to the European Convention for 50 years before actually making the European Convention part of its national legal system, and when judges were required to follow the judgments of the European Court. And it took 50 years for the United Kingdom. Russia, well, it's 12, 14 years. And of course, right now time is running more quickly than in the 50s and the 60s. So many judgments are delivered against Russia. But still, there are quite good changes. We have this Compensation Act. Maybe it's not that effective as one would hope, but it's there. Then we can make further steps to reform it more. There was this initiative of... with €1 billion euros to be invested into reforming the penitentiary system. Of course, another issue is how how many of those money actually reached the penitentiary system. So, about domestication of European Convention and the peace law. First, we will talk about how it looks on the paper, in the law, in the normative framework, and then we will look at the practice of Russian national courts, how it works in reality, and compare. And then it will help us to see actually a more or less objective picture. The Russian Constitution, Professor Marushkin told you about this, it's under the Russian Constitution, any international treaty, including European Convention, is a part of the Russian legal system. Plus, if there is a contradiction between a Russian law and the European Convention, the Convention prevails, has more of a legal force. Of course, it's hard to sometimes hard to establish what is there a contradiction. Quite often, judges or chinovniks in Russia say, yes, convention prevails, but there's no contradiction between Russian law and the European Convention. And you look, if you look at the texts of Russian law, it's sometimes, or it's not sometimes, more often, it's all right, it's okay. But it's about interpretation of the Russian law. And but to interpret the Russian law right now, you have to by referring to the case law of the European Court. And only then you can compare Russian law with the European Convention. So Russian Constitution says that Convention has a stronger legal force than the federal law. It doesn't say anything about the judgment of the European Court or any international tribunals. The Constitutional Court of Russia went further and gave very good interpretation. Apart from the fact that quite often the Constitutional Court refers to the judgments of the European Court, and not only against Russia, but against other countries. And this is a very good example to give to other judges, lower court judges. In one of the judgments of 2nd February 2007, Constitutional Court gave a very good interpretation of Article 15 of the Convention. So it's about the legal force of the Convention. It says it's not only European Convention is the part of the Russian legal system. It's also judgments of the European Court of Human Rights. They are also part of the Russian legal system. And this message was given in many other judgments followed, and also in many articles published by the Chief Justice of the Constitutional Court, Dworkin. In many of his articles and speeches, he repeats the same position that the court mentioned. So it's quite a progressive interpretation of the convention. So it gives more clarity for the other judges to follow. The Russian Supreme Court. Supreme Court of Russia acting in two sort of areas. First of all, as a court of first instance, as a cassation system court to decide particular cases. And another function of the court is to give directions to other judges, lower court judges to follow, that regulates the practice. So it would be unitarian practice in all the country. So in order to do so, the Supreme Court issues so-called regulations by the plenum of the Supreme Court. Plenum is a gathering of all the judges, and they issue these regulations, постановления пленума Верховного Суда. And those regulations are not on particular case, they are on many cases. So they interpret, they gather the practice from different courts on particular issue, and at the end of the day, they analyze it and issue sort of guidance how to deal with particular type of cases. So in 2003, 5 years after ratified the convention, Supreme Court issued a regulation was 5th October. It's a particular regulation devoted to the domestic application of international treaties in Russian courts. And part of this regulation was devoted particularly to the European Convention. It was issued at the time when Russia had only 7 judgments against Russia. 7 judgments by the European Court. There were some important provisions that Supreme Court, some messages that the Supreme Court gave to lower courts. Like the Supreme Constitutional Court, it says that when interpreting the treaty, the European Convention, judges should then take into account the case law of the European Court. Another important element, and we will talk about it later in the part of where we speak about motivation of judges and lawyers to implement the convention. It says that non-application of the convention is a ground to quash a judgment, the reason to quash the judgment. It's a new sort of provision. It does not exist in any codes in Russia.
Yes, it's a really new provision, but the case is that there are general norms in all procedural codes that non-application of norm which is subject to application is a reason for watching the decision. So in this case also, if the convention must be applied but it's not applied, it's also the non implementation of the applicable norm. So I don't think that this particular statement introduced something is extremely new to this system. Maybe it's a good guidance. It's stressed that we must remember that convention is also applicable law. But I think it's not relatively new.
I would agree with you if all the judges in Russia, 15,000, were of the same level of knowledge of international law. They all worked in the Constitutional Court, but they are not. From this point of view, you can say that this is not important too. All you need is the provision of the Russian Constitution.
Yeah.
Convention is part of Russian legal system. Of course, you have to look at the case law of the European Court. It's so obvious for somebody who studied international law. But it's not when you go to the court and you argue and you bring translation of the judgments of the European Court, the judge look at you. Что такое? It's not obvious for them.
No, but
that's why they need this obvious explanation. That's why they need this obvious explanation that yes, in criminal and civil procedure codes, there are provisions that if you didn't apply a material or procedural law, which includes European Convention, your judgments should be cancelled, challenged, abolished. But it's very rarely happens, even after this explanation. We will come to this again later. And so, what was important also, the Supreme Court gave a sort of short overview of all the 7 judgments delivered against Russia. Sort of legal positions of the European Court in those judgments. Very, very short, very brief. But the results important. Important for the reason that there's another opinion that why shall we follow, why judges shall follow case law judgments of the European Court if they are only available in two languages, French and English, and there's no official translation of those judgments into Russian. Now, first of all, there can't be official translation. And second of all,
what do you mean by that there can't be?
Sir?
What do you mean? What do you mean by that there can't be any official translation into Russian?
Because there is only two official
languages. Okay, that's their argument. The argument is there are only two official languages, mm-hmm. French and English, so we can't read them, so
you mean the correct argument?
Well, that's not what I said. It doesn't. You say the answer was there can't be any translation.
I think his point is that there is not for the others as well, not for the Poles, not for the Estonians,
yes,
but for the Germans,
yeah, okay, yeah,
in German language. So yeah, it's ultimately, like we know it from the European Union, it's a question of money translating all these. So if these countries are concerned about this sort of, the answer is they should translate it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I believe it's partly a question of money.
Okay, but they are arguments. So I can expect to know French or English because there's no money to translate.
Well, I'm going to come to this right now.
Okay.
So obviously we face the situation that you can't translate all the case law, even all the major case law, into 47 languages. 45 additional languages. And there is a statute of the Council of Europe which says that there are only two languages, French and English, officially. So it means that it's all up to the state how they will deal with this issue. And my argument is that the Supreme Court is in the form of this the regulation by the plenum of the Supreme Court is extremely well equipped to transfer all this case law into the Russian legal system. To take the most important legal positions of the European Court and regularly publish them in the Supreme Court regulations. These regulations are very much legally binding for a Russian lawyer. When we were studying in the law school, they were like feeding us with this, professors were feeding us with this regulation, saying that read them, learn them, they are the law. And this is the way to transfer the most important case law of the European Court of Human Rights into the Russian legal system, sort of legalize it. You can't obviously physically make translations of all the case law, but there is this way, there is this instrument which is once again very legally binding in the Russian legal system. It's very well accepted by a Russian lawyer. If a Russian lawyer will read the discussed and restated position of the European Court in this regulation, a lawyer will better believe it, better will use it than just a translation, official or unofficial, somewhere else.
Okay. First question: what means official? Because we can also discuss about that. And secondly,
this is official.
What is official?
Official meaning legally binding. That's what I think. And this is, from this point of view, is official and legally binding, and everybody will follow this.
No, but I mean official translation.
But there's no official translation.
No, but okay. But
official, it said, we mean, from my point of view, is that the statute of the Council of Europe says there are three official languages: French, English, and Russian.
Yes.
From this point, moment, Russian.
Yeah, okay.
There is one more variant, probably. Yeah. If we speak about the usage of this European Court of Human Rights decisions on our territory, probably we can establish some kind of official publication from, for example, Ministry of Justice. And if Minister of Justice will translate and publish them, it will be official publication for our court.
For example, but then the second question is, okay, now this official, it's not an entire of the sentence, this is just resume. Yes? So but if I, as a judge, and you want me to apply, you please, law, I mean, I have the right to read the entire to read the entire sentence.
Sure. That's why I'm suggesting the suggestion to use Supreme Court regulation as this instrument.
But it's not the entire sentence.
They will not include the entire decision of the European Court.
No, right. Well, you don't need the entire.
Why not? What? Why? The college just gave us this translation provisionally. Said, well, it's a lot of work. Use of work. It's actually even more difficult than writing a statute, an article. That already says that it's very important to. Of course, it's important to understand it and to read all the entire decision.
But can I also intervene? I mean, one thing is that judges is a profession that I think chronically lack time, mostly in countries like Russia, probably in Estonia, these guys are, you know, they have these cases, so it's also a question of time management. I mean, I have seen a few books have been published in Russia, very fat books, you know, with many translations of these cases. So realistically speaking, you can doubt how many thousand judges in Russia?
15,000.
How many of those 15,000 judges of Russia actually would have the time, the energy to read through all these cases one by one, therefore it's some sort of compromise solution.
That's not a question, but they are expected to do it.
I can't expect a judge to read all these European Court of Human Rights judgments.
You read cases that are relevant.
At least we have the possibility to read them entirely, and not just
learn English, learn French. There are some translations available online. Who Doc system of the European Court of Human Rights right now offers a lot of translations into Russian. There are many things available, but I will give you an example, and maybe we can move forward after this, and maybe we can talk about this after the class. There are many volumes right now of translations of the cases. Of the judgments of the European Court into Russian translations. Big volumes. But the most popular in Russia, the most popular volume is by the former chief register of the European Court of Human Rights, Tesalia, a good friend of Anatoly Ivanovich Kobyl. It's this big book of major cases delivered by the European Court, but only extracts, not full judgments. It's like an encyclopedia. If you're interested, you deal with the case on right to life. You open it, the point right to life. You open the section about right to life, and you have all the extracts of legal positions, or provisions of the European Court of Human Rights judgments. And you read it, you see, this is position of the European Court about this particular issue. If you need more details, you find there is a reference to a case, a name of the case, and you go and read it in English or Russian or French, and then you'll try to find the translation into Russian. This is the way to deal with this right now.
Okay, well then, and every judge should understand at least one foreign language. And as a state, you have to say that.
No.
Yeah. Of course. Not only in Russia, but also in the Netherlands and all the other countries. That's their arguments. And I think
this is one way up. That all these 15,000 should undergo this training on English and legal English.
Yes.
Another one is to do this. Responsible. They have a lot of stuff. A lot of people to work in the Supreme Court. They can take it and translate major legal positions of the European Court and put it into regulation. And it means if this is a legally binding instrument, the judges shall follow this. This is like the law. They don't need to learn English. They just need to read this regulation.
Don't you know why don't they do this? For example, have you sold this idea, for example, to the judges of the Supreme Court? Just for
I published this book and sent it to Lebedev, but I don't know if he read it. I asked to. Well, that's another story of the book. Allow me to move forward because we have some materials to cover. Okay, and this is the. This is how it works in the reality. We have this example of the regulation of the Supreme Court, and this is how the Supreme Court deals with particular cases where the application of the European guarantees are possible, were possible. Since 1998 until 2003, until this regulation, Supreme Court, at least I had access to this number of judgments. And only 12 judgments mentioned the convention. It could be just the name of the convention, it could be the name of the article, sometimes they will cite the full article, but never referred to the case law of the European Court, to none of the judgments. And see, no reference to the ECJ case law. After 2003, until maybe 2008, I researched this number of judgments. A little bit bigger number of cases mentioned the convention, and only 6 out of the 32 out of almost 4,000 refer to the case law of the European Court. This is the Supreme Court. So you see a big disbalance. In the regulation in 2003, your Supreme Court says you should. In order to understand the European Convention, you have to look at the case law of the European Court. At the same time, not before, not even after, it does it. With the Constitutional Court is a better situation. Some recent improvements of the Supreme Court. Yesterday, Judge Kohler mentioned 90 in 2010, I think, or 11, 90 criminal cases were reconsidered based on the judgments of the European Court of Human Rights. But you understand that this happens after the European Court of Human Rights established the violation, not before. Those 90 cases could have considered. The particular criminal case by taking into account the European Convention before those cases went to the European Court, kind of предотвращение of the violation. What's the
Prevention.
Second improvements, Supreme Court started to publish judgments of the of its judgments where they implemented the convention, the case law. In this official publication, bulletin of the Supreme Court. And actually, it's quite important when I conducted interviews with judges, one of the chief justices of the district court in in Ekaterinburg said, what is the convention? He's quite advanced, a judge. He said, what is the convention? It's the case law of the European Court. And where do I look for this case law? I can read this journal, Бюллетень Европейского Суда, Бюллетень of the European Court of Human Rights. Despite the fact that it sounds like an official bulletin of the European Court, it's published by the non-governmental organization, the Club of the Jurist Lawyers in Moscow. He said, I won't trust this. He's quite agreed with you.
Yeah.
I won't trust this publication, but if the Supreme Court will publish the same translation in its bulletin or in its regulation, I will trust it, and as a judge, I will apply it on behalf of the Russian Federation.
But that's okay. Sorry, it's not consequent, I think. Just because the fact that the Supreme Court published that translated it, you should work as a judge independently. You should have the possibility to work independently. Yeah, okay.
But it's about official translation again. If it's the source of this translation, of this publication, is NGO, the judge probably won't apply. But if this comes from the Supreme Court, who will do it? So some positive changes, but again, it's hard to say whether the progress is good or bad or not enough progress. But when you see this kind of examples, it's just appalling. Stakhnovsky versus Russia. Anyone heard about this case? It was considered by a chamber and then by the Great Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights. The issue is, Stakhnovsky was accused of criminal offense and sentenced to maybe 15 or 20 years. It's a very serious sentence, a criminal crime. But at the time of consideration of this case, he was not offered a free advocate, free lawyer, free attorney. So he was sentenced without being represented by a lawyer, although it's required by the Russian Constitution and by the European Convention. He himself wrote an application to the European Court. The European Court communicated this application with the government. And what the government did, they reopened the case of Stakhnovsky. Supreme Court, Moscow, and this at the time of reconsideration of his criminal case, Stakhnovsky was in Chita. If you know where Chita is, it's behind Baikal Lake, maybe 5 days by train. So of course they didn't bring him to Moscow. They established internet video broadcasting, so judges were here, Stakhnovsky was here, so they sort of reconsidered his case. The Supreme Court gave him an advocate, free lawyer, who was, guess where?
In Moscow.
And they gave him this advocate not a month in advance, not 5 days in advance, 50 minutes before the hearing. And how it happened? Judges left the room, only advocate was in the room, and this guy was in front of the camera, and they had 15 minutes to talk over the internet, over the video, not even a telephone, which somehow guaranteed maybe that nobody will listen to it. And of course, Stakhnovsky said, this is a joke, I don't need this advocate, I don't need this lawyer, and the case was reconsidered, he was sentenced to the same. Again, maybe he's guilty, but it's all about procedure and it's all about how the Supreme Court acts, knowing that the case is before the European Court and they somehow trying to fix the issue. but not honestly, not honestly to give a lawyer, a person a right to free lawyer, free legal aid in this criminal case. And of course the European Court of Human Rights didn't accept this reconsideration and condemned the Supreme Court for another violation. So this is how the Supreme Court acts. I don't even have any comments. Give a person 15 minutes to talk with a lawyer who is in Moscow. And Bugrova case. This is a civil case. And it concerns... Yes? This case was heard by the Great Chamber in 2011. I actually don't know what happens afterwards because I'm not a lawyer in this case. And no, I don't actually know. Perhaps it's somewhere published in the Committee of Ministers' resolutions about the execution of the judgment. Bukrova case, I mentioned to you yesterday some details about this case. Bukrova's husband died in a cell in the circumstances that it was overcrowded, there was a fight, somebody beating him up, whether police or his cellmate, and he was left for 16 hours to die in another cell. So Bukrova, when we started to work on this case, we found many violations and many ways of trying to deal with this violation. And one of them was, we discovered that there is a regulation by the government, federal government of Russia, which this regulation about conditions in detention centers, prisons attached to the police stations where Bugrov was detained. And in this regulation by the government, there was one provision which says that inmates are afforded at least 2 square meters per person. And Judge Kohler mentioned today, in Europe, the standards are 7 meters. Of course, 7 is for those who are either in CISO and preliminary detention where they sit for 2 years. It's for the prisons where they sit for many, many years. And this 2 meters for those who they are maybe for overnight or 50 days maximum. But still, 2 square meters. In practice, it was even worse. This cell was 7 square meters and there were 7 to 8 inmates at the same time. So 1 meter less than is great. Space for the grave. So of course we went to the Supreme Court to challenge this regulation, saying that this is the source of all the violations. It's not even about practice, it's in the law. Again, Judge Fowler today mentioned that quite often the law is the source of violation. So that's a violation. We went to the Supreme Court and challenged the regulation by the government, including referring to the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 3, together with the case law and European rules, which establish the 7 square meters. And we kind of sensed that Supreme Court would not want to consider this case because it's about federal government. At this time, the head of the government was Putin, although this particular regulation was signed by his predecessor, Kasyanov. You know, Kasyanov is now in the opposition. Anyway, so we put a paragraph. We kind of guessed that the Supreme Court will look for excuse not to consider this case on the merits. And this excuse would be that Bugrova's rights were not violated. It's Bugrov who died. His rights to life was violated. So we included the paragraph where we refer to the case law of the European Court, particularly to the case of Rantsev versus Cyprus and Russia. It's about disappearance of a death of a girl who was trafficked to Cyprus, where the applicant was a father of the daughter, not a direct victim, but an indirect victim. So we argue that Bugrova is an indirect victim and she can apply to the Supreme Court. And what, guess what? The Supreme Court completely ignored this paragraph and rejected the application, saying that Bugrova didn't mention what kind of rights were violated, her rights. Somehow implying that probably Bugrov should apply to the Supreme Court, stand up from the grave. So this is how the Supreme Court acts. Actually, with the same similar application was sent to the Constitutional Court of Russia, and we are in sending documents back and forth for the last 2 years. Constitutional Court doesn't want to accept this case either. And in February, we sent this case to the European Court of Human Rights. Maybe we have... Are you okay for another 10, 15 minutes? Okay. So, now... It's about... I think it's all about, or mostly about, attitude of judges and lawyers towards application of the convention. This is an extract from the interview from the press conference conducted by the Chief Justice of the Regional Court of Svetlovsk Oblast, Ivan Avchuruk. You could ask any question online and he would answer it. So I asked him a question whether his judges underwent any trainings. He said, no, we don't need to hold any special trainings on the convention. All you need is to apply national law, Article 6. And all will be fine. So judges don't really have to know international law. It's kind of funny that this was a press conference called Judges Shall Know Everything. Yeah. And it's interesting that this was a conference in 2004, 1 year after the case of Markevich versus Russia. And Markevich versus Russia originated in this particular court, in this regional court. No changes, no conclusions were made. I will just summarize the interviews that I conducted with judges and lawyers, advocates who argued cases. And I found out that there is basically, when you speak to a judge and ask a simple question, do you ever apply to the European Convention? Do you need to apply? They would say, no, we don't apply it. We wish we can, but none of the advocates, none of the parties which comes to our hearings actually raise the issue of direct application of the Convention using additional arguments. I would not do it on my own initiative. Why? And I couldn't understand, because, for example, Chikalovsky District Court in Yekaterinburg, all the judges are obliged to consider all the cases, criminal, civil, administrative, and now they have to know extra body of law, the European Convention. And of course, on their own initiative, they won't do it. It's up to a lawyer. They have to come to the hearing and actually argue, bring ahead these arguments, prepare translations, prepare a written memorandum on the European Convention. And only then the judge will probably do something. But it's interesting when you speak to this advocate from whom judges expect some moves. Advocates, they should quite knowledgeable, all of them quite knowledgeable about the European Convention. They know some judgments, they can argue whether the this judgment of the European Court was just or not. So when you speak to advocates, they say, well, we would be happy to bring forward this our cases based on the European Convention. We would be happy to prepare memorandums and submit it to the files of the case. But the problem is the judges will not listen to us. I would do such a big amount of work, and this will not guarantee me any results. My clients will not pay me for this kind of work. They pay me for the results. So, and you see, there's this kind of vicious circle. It doesn't happen when judges expect something from advocates, and advocates expect something from the judge. And it doesn't happen. The only example, the only exception is lawyers of non-governmental organizations. They quite often argue their cases based on the European Convention, and it's for the reason that their goal is not only to protect a particular victim. And so they have a broader goal to advance human rights issues. And so in order to do so, they bring to the attention of a judge arguments based on the convention. Maybe sometimes it can make judges angry, but they do it. Again, the situation is changing. If you compare what was in 1998, right after Russia ratified the convention, and the beginning of 2000, and the situation which is right now is quite different. Before, when our lawyers would come to a judge and start to argue based on the convention, the judge would say, it's kind of a provocation, stop referring to a foreign law. Okay, foreign law. This is how European Convention was understood, foreign law. Some judges thought that European Court of Human Rights was in The Hague. Some judges were so angry with lawyers arguing based on the case law of the European Court, they would say, stop, you are referring to the convention, otherwise I will call a bailiff to get me responsible. And then he will take you out of the courtroom as a violation, as a punishment. Recently we had a conversation with Judge Kohler, and he said this, I see from the cases which are coming to the European Court that the further you are from the Supreme Court, the better judgments are in terms of application of the European Convention. And I would agree with him, because it's actually visible that if you are somewhere not in the Supreme Court, somewhere in the District Court, and you prepare a good case, you develop good arguments based on the convention, the case law, it's more likely that a judge would actually listen to you and implement the convention, put it in the judgment. And also it depends on how often, how persistent you are. I will refer to you an example of a judge who was the only judge in the original court of Svetlovsk Oblast who considered cases as a first instance, not as a cassation. And this particular judge was considering cases against the regional government. So each time we had a case against the government, against the regional government, we would go to this particular judge. And we started to argue the first time before this particular judge, based on the convention in 1998. And it took 4 years, consistent cases where we argued based on the convention, until for the first time she actually looked, opened the book, opened the convention, opened the case law, and referred to the European Convention and the case law. And then, maybe a year after, even the defendant, the representative of the governor and the representative of the regional government, they prepared a cassation appeal based on the European Convention. It was, we lost this case, but it was the best result we could ever receive. We made the judge to look at the case law. We made the defendant to look at the case law. And they made the Supreme Court, which considered it an appeal, to look at the case law. This is sort of the way to educate judges. Just some recommendation apart from what I already mentioned, that Supreme Court is responsible for bringing this body of case law of the European Court into the Russian legal system through the regulations by the plenum of the Supreme Court. This is very important. And of course, we have to think about the education. Still, there are many, very little courses in Russian law schools which gives you information about European Convention. Like particular courses, or also quite often European Convention challenges a particular branch of Russian law, like administrative law. Just a short example, right now in some administrative cases, detention of a protestant who was protesting on the street and police took him, this person, if he is being accused for not following the orders of the policeman, he might be sentenced to 15 days in detention. And from the point of view of the European Court and the Convention, this is a criminal offense. This is a criminal charge. And everybody who is criminally charged has a right to free advocate, free lawyer. And this is not in the Russian law. So this is an example of how the European Convention challenges the Russian law. And if you teach administrative law in a Russian law school, you have to refer in your course to the case law of the European Court to give the student complete information. And of course, it's important to have this master's degree program in international human rights law. In 2003, when I started to be interested in more details in the European Convention, I wanted to study it somewhere, and there's no way I could study it in Russia. The only opportunity I found was in England, in the University of Essex. And the situation didn't change much in Russia. If you want to learn European Convention, it's either through practice or you go abroad.
What do you think? There's this new master program in People's Friendship University in Moscow on international human rights law. I saw advertising this training.
I don't know much about this because I only see advertisements. I was in touch with some people from this program, and they promised. They this was the initiative to invite to speak at one of the seminars that I never was invited finally. I don't know what's going on. I know that there are 2 years since they started to the graduates. There were about 30 graduates, I know. Well, at least it's the first first initiative. But also, the problem is, this is in Moscow. Everything is in Moscow. I know some people who were studying in these programs from Altai Krai. And do you think they come back to Altai? No, they go further, to Italy, to some European countries. Yeah, I should refer to the president. at this former president. When I heard this speech by the president, yes.
I just want to ask you, what's the role of the Constitutional Court? They have a mandate to make sure that lower courts comply with the Constitution and the Bible. What is the role of the Constitutional Court in the Russian legal system? Do they feature that legislation and lower court judgments are in compliance with the Constitution?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, there are no constitutional courts in Russia.
Okay.
In terms of there's only one constitutional court, the federal court. In the regions, there are, in general, we can call them regional courts. Some of them are called oblast courts, some of them are called constitutional courts. But the function is not to look whether regional legislation is in compatibility with the constitution. They consider general cases, like criminal cases. Sometimes they can consider cases whether regional legislation is compatible with federal.
What about subjects?
Well, charter courts, constitutional courts.
But they're
only
the
17. They're not in every subject of the Russian Federation. Out of 80, they maybe 17, 20, and they usually deal with 5-10 cases per year. It's a very small amount of cases.
Is it on the Supreme Court that has?
The Constitutional Court has this task, Russian Federation Constitutional Court. And the Supreme Court considers some of the cases in terms of compatibility of federal governmental acts with the Russian federal law, not with the Russian Constitution. If it's about compatibility with the Russian Constitution, it's all about constitutional court. Yes?
Have you ever confronted the local judges with these kind of statements made by federal authorities? Like, justice must be administered by the same case of the three times? Like, when you talk to the local judge?
Yes. Before the district judge, you better refer to this regulation by the Supreme Court. Regulation that is signed by the Supreme Court is more effective for them.
Okay.
So it's sticky.
But do they still say we don't want to apply foreign laws?
No. I'm sorry. I started about the 90s.
Okay.
But I didn't mention what is right now.
Yeah.
Right now you won't hear this reaction.
Okay.
Judges, some of them are just listening, but then ignore it. But they listen. Before they would even listen. Some of them would cite legal positions of the European Court, but not without referring to particular cases, the national case, Wolfdorf versus Russia or something else. Some of the judges are really brave and they quote European Court human rights judgments. And it's about how it works in the Russian legal system. Judges are usually very, very much aware of how many judgments by their judgments will be cancelled by the next level of the courts, of the court, in the original court. And then their career depends on this, statistics. So we always look up and think, if I refer to this European Court case, or to the convention in general, whether they will like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are not sure that they will like it, they will better ignore it. Or they will refer maybe to some legal position, but without mentioning the case, the particular case of the European Court. So this is another obstacle for direct application of the convention. You always think how the upper court would react. So this statement of the Russian president, which was made in Zasidanie, a meeting with all the heads of all these Russian Supreme Courts, then he refers that we should apply international law. And the Minister of Justice afterwards repeat this, and this is also extraordinary for a lawyer from Russia, not a precedent system country. Judges must administer justice by taking into account the case law of the European Court. Sounds good, but I won't go further right now. I will leave everything which I had left for tomorrow. I just refer you to this article which I think you have in your materials. It's in English, and it gives you a short overview, 40 pages short overview of how whatever I said today is in this article. Also, I gave you this book yesterday, and I forgot to mention that right now, apart from working for helping the NGO Sutyazhnik, I'm running a human rights project in Russia, which helps small NGOs to stand up, to raise their capacity, if I may say. And in our program, it's called Я в праве, we published this book. And all the materials that you find here are, it's not just a collection of articles. We work with all these people. They run particular seminars, trainings for NGOs, and we put these materials in the book. And there are two materials published by, one by me and another one by Olga Shepirova, and it's all about the European Court of Human Rights and its application of these judgments in Russian legal system. So, and also there's this book. It's my book. It's on the European Convention in Russian courts. It's in Russian. Unfortunately, it's not available online. It's not free. It's only in the shops. It's a condition of the publisher. But there are more detailed information about what happens in Russia in this area. And tomorrow, I guess it will be more interesting. We will speak about particular cases that NGOs litigated strategically. How one case bring up another case, or maybe a tree of cases. How we looking for strategic cases, and how in practice we try to implement the European Convention in Russian courts. Thank you. All right. Yesterday's lecture I published on the website, and I put the link in your Facebook group of this school. And I will do the same thing.
So, whoever stays for the movie, please meet me in the lobby at 2:00 p.m.